I'm afraid I'm going to start off with some bad news. Some of you may have heard that just down the road from where I live in Easton, near the main building of Kensington Baptist Church, on Friday morning in the early hours, somebody was stabbed in a pub or near a pub and had to be taken to hospital. If any of you were travelling down there on Friday morning, you might have seen the roadblocks. Having said that, it would be great to see you all tonight at 6 p.m. at Kensington in Easton for our evening service. That kind of thing might not be an everyday occurrence here in Emerson's Green. I don't know, ask Tom. But doesn't God have anything to say about this kind of thing? Why doesn't God stop those things happening? People might not be stabbed down your road if you live in Emerson's Green. But there are other things closer to home that come along to challenge God to say, no, I don't think God is really in control. I don't think he is really good. But doesn't God care that your children are struggling at school or they're ill? And doesn't he hear me crying out night after night because I just can't get rid of that sin? Or doesn't God want that person to become a Christian? I do. Doesn't he hear me? This passage that Lynn read for us will take us into some of God's promises and what that looked like for a certain group of people at a certain time. But remember, this is the same God that we follow now. So let's have a look at some of God's promises. We've seen up to this point in Exodus that the Israelites have been in slavery in Egypt and they've been crying out to God for a deliverer. Moses looks like he might be that guy, that deliverer, but he messes up and kills a man. He's been in exile in the land of Midian, away from Egypt, for 40 years. And now God has appeared to him in the famous burning bush incident, telling Moses who he is. I am who I am. And now he is about to give Moses a mission. So verses 16 and 17, look down at those. They say, go, assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. And I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. So Moses is to go and assemble the elders, the ones who can best organize the people, and spread the message that he'd been given. So God tells Moses to use certain words. When he addresses them, he appeals to their history. God talks about himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He appeared to them, the three famous ancestors of the Israelites, and he called them to follow him. He made promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give them a land, to make them into a great nation. It was to them that God made those promises. But it was now to their descendants God is about to fulfill them. He is a promise-keeping God. What he has said, he is sure to do. He is the one that the Israelites in slavery have been crying out to for centuries. They've been there 400 years in Egypt. God says that he has been watching over them. And now he says he will act. But it's not that God looked down and suddenly thought, oh wow, these people are really in trouble. I better do something about it. No, he had had all of this planned way before. Back when he spoke to Abraham in Genesis 15, verses 13 to 14, this is what it says. Then the Lord said to him, that's Abraham, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and ill-treated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. So this was always part of God's plan, and now was the time to act on it. God's plan can even include things that we don't like, things that seem difficult or awkward. Like, why does he leave them 400 years to suffer in slavery? Maybe for you, why isn't that person I love becoming a Christian? I've done all I can. They've heard the gospel, but they're not interested. Why doesn't God do something? But we can know for sure that his plan is always good. And that God sees the big picture, the long-term goal, and can work through any difficulty to get there. We'll see more of that in the rest of the book of Exodus. But even here, God is promising something that seems incredibly hard. There's no way these slaves can challenge the most powerful empire in the world unless God does something amazing. He says in verse 20, I will stretch out my hand and I will strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. After that, he, that is Pharaoh, will let you go. So God's method for convincing Pharaoh to let the Israelites go does not sound nice and sanitized, does it? He stretches out his hand of judgment. But remember, this is still the same speech from the previous week's passage, where God reveals who he is. He hasn't actually stopped speaking since, he hasn't stopped speaking to Moses since he said, I am who I am, all the way back in verse 14. And this is still part of his character, his nature that he is revealing to Moses. This is the kind of God that he is. Pharaoh is trying to oppose God and prevent his promises from being fulfilled. And of course, God cannot allow that. He has to deal with Pharaoh as he deserves. And that is a good thing. Because then it means that he can fulfill the promises that he has made to Israel and set them free. Notice as well in verses 21 and 22, the people are to plunder the Egyptians, to take stuff away from their former captors with them when they leave. Because God says he will make the Egyptians favorably disposed to the Israelites. No way. The Egyptians are not going to give up their free labor with a smile on their face. Seems crazy. But God has promised. And he is the promise-keeping God. He will manage to do it. Impossible though it might seem at the moment. And we'll see it fulfilled as we keep reading through Exodus in the future. Before we move on from this little section, we probably should deal with a potentially tricky issue that comes up in verse 18. I wonder if you noticed it. Does God want Moses to lie to Pharaoh? He says that they want to go a three-day journey into the wilderness to worship God, to offer sacrifices, but is that all? Is God trying to get the Israelites onto a holiday visa and then they can leg it once they're out? No, and we definitely can't accuse God of lying. He knows, doesn't he, in verse 19, that the king of Egypt will not let you go, even if they only ask for a few days off. How much less will he want to let them go if they ask for complete freedom? The request is not there to trick Pharaoh, but what it does do is anger him. And he shows his hatred of God and of God's people. And there's more to it than just that. In Egyptian society, Pharaoh was seen as a god. He was there among the pantheon of Egyptian gods, and he was supposed to have supernatural power. Oops. Never mind. Whatever he commanded was done not because he was the elected representative of his people, but because he was a god. You have to do what he says. What Moses is to ask him is really to acknowledge the existence of another god, a supreme god, a greater god than Pharaoh. A god who can make demands of Pharaoh and challenge his divinity. God is saying, these are my people. They will worship me, not you. You let them go. If Pharaoh lets them go to worship, even for just a few days, he would be submitting himself to to the one true God, and he can't bring himself to do that. And God knows that he won't be able to do it. But there is one way of getting Pharaoh to let the people go. God continues, says in verse 19, I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. God knows what Pharaoh's reaction will be and promises that he will still be able to do what he said he would. Pharaoh gets his chance. The consequences for disobeying God's plan are serious. God himself will act in power to save his people. And nothing, not even the most powerful empire in the world, can stand up against him. In the contest between God and any other challenger, there is only one outcome. He's promised that he is stronger. How about a God who can keep his promises like that, who is unchallenged? So we've seen a little bit about God's promises, and he promises deliverance, and he is powerful enough to fulfill that promise. Now let's look at God preparing his deliverer. So we move on into chapter 4. Moses is actually still not convinced. If you look at 4 verse 1, it says, Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? Actually, if you've got an NIV translation, what the Bible's on the seats, it's a bit weak. The translation is not quite accurate. There isn't the what if there in the original Hebrew. If you've got an ESV or maybe something else, it might translate it better. The ESV says, they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Moses is doubting. And really, who could blame him? If you were told to go to a people who'd been in slavery for 400 years and you said, God appeared to me in a bush and it was burning, but it wasn't burning, and he told me that you wouldn't be slaves anymore and that you would steal all the Egyptian stuff when you leave, would you expect people to really pay much attention? It sounds crazy. And there's something else that we have to remember. A long time ago, when Moses was still in Egypt, the last time he was there, he thought that he could rescue the people by himself. In Exodus chapter 2, verse 11 to 12, he killed an Egyptian to save a Hebrew. He thought he was trying to do good. Maybe he thought he was the one to save the people. And even though he was God's chosen deliverer, he tried to go about it in his own way, not waiting for God. So Moses had to flee to Midian, into exile. And he'd been keeping flocks in the desert for 40 years, probably disillusioned and disappointed, not feeling at all like a great savior. That time had changed him. And now he isn't confident at all. Even if he knows what he's seen, and maybe he trusts God, he doesn't think that people will listen to him. His fear that the elders won't listen to him is exactly the opposite, though, of what God has just said in chapter 3, verse 18, which we looked at. The elders of Israel will listen to you, God said. God is revealing himself as the promise-keeping God, but Moses is already doubting him. You might think, come on, Moses, don't you get it yet? But God doesn't seem to be angry. And instead, he gives him signs to show to the Israelites, to prove who he is, to prove that he really was sent from God. In fact, he almost treats him like a child. Have a look. Now, he gives him step-by-step instructions. Look at 4 verse 2. Then the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? What's that in your hand, Moses? Almost like he's treating him like a child, step-by-step. A staff, Moses replied. God is coming alongside him and gently guiding him. He knows this is all still a big shock to Moses. But if it wasn't enough of a shock, he has more of a surprise when God does what he does next. If you look at verse 3, God tells him to throw the staff on the ground and it becomes a snake. He wasn't expecting that. What was God doing in this sign? It must be more than just a surprise. Was he fed up of Moses' hesitation and just wanted to kill him and find someone else to do his job? No, there must be something else in this. Primarily, of course, if you look down at verse 5, this is a sign to prove to the elders that God had indeed sent Moses. He was doing something that only God could do. It was a sign, it was also a sign to Moses himself that God was with him, to reassure him, and that he could go ahead on the, with the mission that God had set him. It wasn't all a dream. Nothing snaps you back to reality faster than having a snake appear in front of you. Maybe we could all go down to like a Limbs afterwards and play around with Fluffy. I've heard he's pretty big. But why did God choose this particular sign? He could have turned the staff into a skipping rope or a chocolate biscuit or anything if he wanted to. But he chose a snake. So why is that? Well, snakes were really important in the culture of Egypt at the time. It was a symbol that Pharaoh wore on his headdress. There should be, there's a picture coming up behind. It was a symbol of his divine authority. God was saying through this sign, I have power to control. I have authority over Pharaoh, that is, over everything that is opposed to Israel, everything that's keeping them captive. I have authority, I have the power to control Pharaoh. And then, of course, God tells Moses to pick up the snake by the tail to show his defeat of the enemies of Israel. He can completely subdue them and make them as lifeless as a stick again. But if Moses thought it was all over and he was safe, he had another thing coming. If you look down at verse 6 now, the Lord said, put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, it was leprous, like snow. Now, I have to admit, when I first read this, I thought it'd be great to bring a bag of flour, stick it in my shirt to illustrate this point. But it might get a bit messy, and we don't want any more trouble with the school. So I have to imagine Moses' hand is gone white, is diseased. We aren't told Moses' reaction here, but even though he couldn't run away from his own hand, he would have been at least as horrified at this as he was at the snake. To have leprosy at that time would have been a death sentence. I mean, you had to be quarantined away from the rest of the people. You couldn't have any contact. You couldn't go and meet God even. You were unclean. You had to stay separate. It's amazing that Moses can still stand before God, even for this short amount of time, in his state of uncleanness with this leprous hand. And in verse 7, God heals him, so panic over once again. So what does that one show? This is another sign. God is the one who has power over sickness and health. He is the one who can heal his people and has mercy on those who are suffering. But he is also the one who has power to bring plague. That power will be shown in a devastating way through the rest of the book of Exodus as we read on. And finally, God tells Moses, take some of the water from the Nile and pour it onto dry ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. Down in verse 9. He's not asked to practice this miracle here, because the Nile isn't here, of course. And the significance of this one is tied up very closely with the land of Egypt itself. So the River Nile, you might remember from your primary school lessons, is the life of Egypt. Without it, the country could not exist. In an otherwise dry and desert place, the Nile brought fertility and crops, brought water. It was absolutely necessary for the country to exist. So by turning the water from the Nile into blood, God is saying something really important. He has power over life and death, over Egypt itself. So all these three signs together, we've seen God means that God has power over Pharaoh, over sickness, and finally over life. Moses is to prove to the Israelites that he has been sent from God, and God is the only one with this power. He must be telling the truth. So for us today, Does that mean anything? Have you ever seen a burning bush or picked up a snake and it turned into a stick? No one? I don't think so. But have you ever been completely overwhelmed or stuck, as the Israelites were? Back in December, my grandfather died of cancer. He lived in Australia, so there was nothing I could do. I couldn't just pop over and see him. And all his life, up into his 80s, he was then. He had gone his own way, and he believed in something, his own personal religion. But it wasn't the God of the Bible. It wasn't this God. He didn't know Jesus. I prayed for him, of course, but I hated just waiting and waiting for the inevitable to happen. He faced imminent death any day, the doctor said. But he didn't have saving faith in Jesus. And I knew what that meant. I meant that means if he died without knowing Jesus, then he would face an eternity of punishment in hell, away from God, because he had rejected God. But just a month before he died, a close family member sat down with him, had a man-to-man chat, and challenged him directly about what he believed. Do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Do you believe that he died to forgive you from your sin? And praise God, he repented and gave his life to Jesus just a month before he died. Now everyone here, maybe apart from a couple of people, you've lived longer than me. You've probably seen more people die. You've seen more difficulty and struggle than I have. And I don't want to suggest that everyone's story will end like that. It doesn't always happen. But what kind of God do we have? Do we have a kind of God who always does what is right, even if we can't see it at the time? God calls us to trust him, to place our confidence completely on him, because he will always do good. Does that make sense? Does that sound like you? Do you find yourself really, really trusting God when those difficulties come, when you're trying to get your kids into school and the school doesn't want them, you're outside the right area, or you've got to find some money for your mortgage, you've got to find a new job, you've lost a job, you're having difficulty with family. Does that trust in God come in then? Or maybe you don't even think in those categories because you've become so used to relying on yourself. I think looking around Village Church and most churches, there's a whole lot of self-confidence. Not in God, but in ourselves. And maybe we don't even think of that. It doesn't cross our radar. We don't stop to consider whether we should be trusting in God's promises instead. What does God promise? That he will be with us, doesn't he? That he will love us, that not that everything will go like we want it to go, but it will go as he wants it to go. And he is a promise-keeping God. We don't have any need to fear. Ultimately, he will do what is good. The God who met with Moses in this passage is the same God we worship today. This passage shows us a God who loves his people, and who is unwilling to let them stay in trouble. It shows us a God who does amazing things to prove that he is God and to save his people. It's commonly understood that the angel of the Lord, flew back in Chapter 3, verse 2, it talks about it's the angel of the Lord who appears in the burning bush. It's commonly understood that this angel of the Lord is none other than the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God himself. He repeatedly makes himself known to Moses and the Israelites throughout their story, and to others in the Old Testament. He's not absent. The Son of God is there in the Old Testament. But when he finally comes as a man, Jesus, the Son of God, the one who had demonstrated his power over evil and good and sickness and health and death and life. He died, hanging on the cross there in agony. He did not look like he was a God who is in control. But this was God's way of fulfilling his plan. This was the ultimate way. In weakness, Jesus did the most powerful thing ever. He defeated death and evil decisively, finally, completely. What Moses saw in part, we have seen fulfilled in Jesus. And one day he promises he will come back to clean up the mess left by that great snake, Satan, in his death throes. That is a promise we can completely rely on. He has shown himself to be trustworthy. We can trust in him, not in ourselves. Just this morning I was reading Isaiah 40. It's quite a famous one. Welcome to turn to it if you like. From verse 6, it says this. The voice says, "Cry out," and I say, "What shall I cry? All men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, and the flowers fall, because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, and the flowers fall, but the word of God stands forever." Now, in your translation, you probably have in verse 6, "All their glory is like the flowers of the field." It turns out that under there is a Hebrew word, chesed, which means faithful covenant love that God shows to his people. If you want to know more about why it says glory in English translation, then come speak to me afterwards. But maybe it could be better translated, "All their faithfulness is like the flowers of the field." And compared with God's faithfulness, his word, which stands forever. I hope that something has challenged you about where you put your trust. Don't want it to be in yourself, because our faithfulness is weak and frail, and it will fall apart. But God's will not. He's given us great promises. And for us, Satan will not let us go unless a mighty hand compels him. Jesus has shown that mighty hand, and he is able to save anyone who trusts in him. Absolutely. Guaranteed. I think it's time to sing our final song. Give thanks to the Lord, our God and King.